Welcome to Common Good, the Values and Capitalism podcast brought to you by the American Enterprise Institute. This is Tyler Castle coming from downtown Washington, D.C. in the 11th floor studio at AEI. Our guest this episode is Congressman Adrian Smith, who represents Nebraska's 3rd Congressional District in the U.S. House of Representatives. In our conversation, we talk about how and why he got into politics and how his faith affects his approach to public service. We also discuss the outlook for D.C. politics at the start of a new congressional term. And more personally, he shares about his recent marriage, describing how he manages to balance personal life with an incredibly busy work life. We'll take a short break and be back with Congressman Adrian Smith. Stay with us. We're back with our guest, Congressman Adrian Smith. A native of Western Nebraska, Congressman Smith has represented Nebraska's 3rd District in the U.S. House of Representatives since 2007 and serves on the House Ways and Means Committee. So if I'm doing my math right, this is your 5th term in office, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, that's a significant chunk of time now.
It is, but it's gone quickly, let me say.
Yeah, I bet. Well, thanks for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
It's great to be here. Appreciate the work that AEI does. It's very informative and I think good for our country.
We appreciate hearing that. So just to get things started, how did you get into politics in the first place? You know, there's a lot of kids out there who are, I want to be a congressman when I grow up. I want to be a president. You actually are one. So not president yet, but you're a congressman. So how did you, was it something you always had aspirations of? How did you get into it?
You know, my grandfather is most responsible for my political involvement as an individual. And the irony is that he was a staunch Democrat. But he was actually a federal retiree who thought all Republicans were out to take his pension, even though that now history has no evidence of that. But my grandfather always watched the evening news, and he would talk about what's going on. He wasn't a political activist. I never knew him to have a yard sign or a bumper sticker. But he would watch the evening news and then talk about it over dinner. And I mean, he taught me the states and capitals when I was little, even some foreign countries and capitals. But you know, I remember discussing with him our hostages in Iran. I remember hearing how he really liked Jimmy Carter, one of the few people in Nebraska, perhaps, who liked Jimmy Carter as president. But I remember the neighbors liked Ronald Reagan. I remember that fall of 1980, I was a 4th grader. I finally asked my parents, who had become Reagan Democrats by that point. I said, you know, what's the difference? My grandpa likes Jimmy Carter, my parents like Ronald Reagan, you know, what's the difference? So my parents walked me through the difference between those two candidates. And by the end of that next day, I would say, I thought, well, I want Reagan. So I ended up keeping a tally of electoral votes for Ronald Reagan election night 1980 in the 4th grade.
Okay, so that was the start of it. Is your grandfather still around?
No, he's been gone since 1996.
So he wasn't alive to see you in Congress as a Republican.
Right. He was alive when I was elected city council, and not when I was a state senator. But you know, I oftentimes though think, you know, what would he think of what's going on today? Mm-hmm. And I think he was starting to turn Republican shortly before he passed away. But he was a hardworking man. Who would always look for solutions. And that's what I really got from him as well, of being a part of the solution. And so that's how and why I serve today.
Okay. Well, that's something we can all agree on, I think, Democrats and Republicans. So after you graduated, you worked in the governor's office in Nebraska, if I'm right?
Well, during college, okay, I worked, I interned in the governor's office. And then I graduated college in Lincoln, Nebraska, University of Nebraska. Moved back to my home area where I'm fifth generation, mm-hmm. and worked in education for a time while I served on city council, and then I left education to run for state senator. Got elected, served 8 years there then before running for Congress.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So and you're a Christian believer. How did your faith impact you getting into politics, and how does it affect your view of it now?
You know, scriptures are a terrific guide in how we should treat others. Certainly, the scriptures also really talk about the human condition and ultimately why Christ died on the cross for our sins. And, you know, certainly it's hard for the government to establish all of those applications biblically and scripturally across public policy. But I think what the government is most capable of doing is ensuring religious freedom for us to practice our faith. for us to understand that as long as human beings are involved, nothing will be perfect. And, you know, whether it's human beings in government, whether it's human beings out there in the economy. And so we want to look for policies where the government doesn't need to be so involved, where we can have, you know, human beings accountable in a way that, you know, it can build the economy through that accountability. And that, I think, translates to capitalism. And in so many ways, though, I think it's important to note that scriptures are a great guide for life. It's hard to mandate that sort of thing all the time. But I know that when it comes to protecting life, that's a pretty easy one for me. And I've always been pro-life and see the government, a fundamental function of government as needing to protect life.
Mm-hmm. So with your journey coming into politics and also that perspective, which is a kind of traditional conservative perspective that government can't do everything, kind of seems like you might not want to go into politics, but would you have anything to say for the young person, maybe conservative, maybe in particular a Christian, who is interested in politics? Would you have anything to say to them while they're on a similar journey as you are, you've been?
Well, we need young people to be involved, number one. And I once heard someone say that, you know, young people are, you know, a certain percentage of our population, but 100% of our future. And that, I think, was well stated when you look at what our country is facing. And I also see young people with some great ideas. And some of those ideas are for the political context. Some of it might be in the private sector better utilized. But we want people to be involved from the local community. You know, I know that when I was on city council, there weren't very many people. In fact, no one from the public would show up that I recall to our budget hearings. Mm. And now, you know, you look at things budgetary these days across government, all sizes of government. We need more people involved.
Yeah, I know they need to know that.
That's right.
Okay. So you, let's go back a few years. You came to Capitol Hill for the first time in 2007. When you first came here, was there anything that surprised you? Was there anything about the work or the environment that you kind of expected to be different, that was completely different than what you thought it would be?
Well, yeah, I came here, you know, first time as a member of Congress in 2007. Of course, my very first time to Washington, D.C. was in college. So I was never that fourth grader or that eighth grader getting to travel to Washington, D.C. like many do. But when I look back, though, you know, that was when the Republicans were newly in the minority. Nancy Pelosi was Speaker. You know, I'd always heard that, you know, leadership puts pressure on you to vote a certain way. Well, when you're in the minority and Nancy Pelosi is setting the agenda, that draws most Republicans together. And so we had, you know, a couple of more contentious votes, but by and large, that those 4 years in the minority were much less stressful, shall I say, other than seeing the country go in the wrong direction, much less stressful than trying to muster the votes to get a budget bill passed, to get the appropriations bills passed, and really pursuing the process that our founders had in mind. But what keeps me going every day that I serve is thinking back to what our founders had in mind. And even amidst our challenges today, even amidst the troubles that we're facing as a country, our founders set up a very good system. And we want to focus on that and how we can utilize this process to bring about the solutions that we know are good for America.
Mm-hmm. So you just spoke a little bit about being in the minority. Now, obviously, in both sides of Congress, Republicans have a majority. So how do you see the strategy changing in the next 2 years as opposed to what it was before?
Well, you know, having the Senate and Mitch McConnell setting the agenda, while we probably can't get everything we want, I'm very encouraged that we will get a lot more than what we would have gotten under Harry Reid as the majority leader. So that can speak for itself. But also, you know, we've got this process that we need to utilize. And the only thing worse than a process that moves too slowly is a process that moves too quickly. That's what happened with Obamacare. Mm-hmm. You know, so we need to utilize the process. That's what brings all members to the table, not just leadership. And that's, in effect, then what brings more of the American people to the table to participate in the debate, to participate in the exchange of ideas. You know, I consider this the marketplace of ideas, and we want to market our product well. Now, we as conservatives, we're more independent-minded. We're not very good at sticking together, to be quite honest with you. And the other side is very good at sticking together. That's just a different mentality. Individuals, we think, you know, how can we, you know, take care of ourselves and then take care of others, and have a good process or a good result from that. And yet we have to come together to pass legislation, you know, in the House and then conference committee after the Senate does their version, perhaps. But no bill will ever be perfect, like I said, because human beings are involved very directly. And so we need to do what we can to bring legislation forward that moves our country in the rightward direction, so that we can pursue conservative solutions that we know are better for America than the alternative.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you realize that any legislation that you do pass, there's a looming presidential veto because President Obama is still in office for 2 years. So do you see there being any particular areas of collaboration possible between a Republican Congress and a Democratic president?
Well, if you use the State of the Union speech from the other night as what the president is wanting to do, of course, he talked about working together, and I think he also leveled a record number of veto threats all in the same speech. It's a little frustrating, but let me look on the more hopeful side. And in terms of foreign trade, international trade, you know, the president, it's taken him 6 years to really get to this point, but I'm encouraged that we can do a trade agreement or two, you know, based on what he said, that he wants the Trade Promotion Authority that is the necessary precursor to getting some trade agreements done. So I hope that we can work together to do that. I think it's good for America. It establishes our leadership in the world. When we are willing to tackle trade issues, it generates and develops better relationships, geopolitical relationships around the world as well.
Mm-hmm. And I know one of your other priorities is tax reform. Do you think there's any possibility of that moving forward, maybe more so than there has been in the past? And I know a lot of people, especially on the Republican side, see that as being a key to unleashing economic growth. Is there any possibility for movement forward on that?
It's moving slowly. I'm still hopeful that we can get some simplification in the tax code. Right now, our tax code is so complex that it's easier for people to cheat and harder for people to comply. And that's a terrible formula. And when it comes to the revenues, when we need revenues to pay for some fundamental functions of government, from protecting Americans from our enemies or building roads or some of the fundamental other functions. So we need a more legitimate tax code because it's so complex. When you look at the compliance costs, we're talking $168 billion every year.
Wow.
Just to comply. That's not even including the actual tax bill.
Yeah.
That the Americans have to pay, the American people. And so we have a tax system that is just not working. And so many of our policies are hurting the very individuals that the programs are supposed to help. And, you know, you take Obamacare. When I hear from Nebraskans who have lost their insurance as a result of Obamacare, that tells me that the Obamacare policies out of Washington, D.C. are accomplishing the exact opposite. At least that's what most folks would think.
Taking a step back a little bit and looking at the broad landscape of America right now, what do you see as being America's greatest policy challenge, and what do you think we should do about that?
You know, the greatest policy challenge, I think, is looking down the road and the sustainability of some of our programs. Now, the sooner we address these, you know, whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, the sooner we address these challenges, the easier it will be. You know, the longer we wait, the harder it gets. But I also look at, though, tax reform shouldn't be as difficult as it is, and yet it is a heavy lift. We have an environment now where, you know, the core of power in Washington, D.C. is the tax code. And it has created quite an industry of special interests only doing the human thing, you know, wanting more for themselves. And Scripture tells us that can get out of hand.
Yeah.
Sometimes. But, you know, we have to push back. Looking back at 1986 tax code or tax reform, before 1986, interest payments on credit card debt was tax deductible. That interest was tax deductible. 1986 says, no, that's not going to be tax deductible anymore. There was a lot of noise, shall we say, of saying, oh, that's going to be bad for business. That's going to undermine our economy in certain ways. And yet I would say the credit card industry has grown and thrived in big ways. And so I think we as policymakers with the American people need to step back and say, okay, a more simplified tax code is going to generate more revenue long term, but we need it to be revenue neutral in the short term so that we can build that economy and provide more opportunity for the future.
So on those two issues in particular that you mentioned there, tax policy and entitlements, I think one of the big paradoxes that I don't even know how you face this. This is why I'm asking this. But how do you balance doing what you personally think is right for the country with what your constituents might ask of you, especially on the issue of entitlements? I know this is a huge sort of a line to walk. So how do you kind of balance those two different factions and when you're making decisions?
Well, I was stopped by an elderly lady in the district a while back who told me she was more concerned about her grandchildren's future than, you know, the programs that she might benefit from today. And we're starting to hear more of that. And that's what we need to focus on. You know, all too often, Washington, D.C. works with 30-second sound bites. That's what the political advertisements are out every campaign cycle and election cycle. And we need to dive deeper. That's our job as elected members of Congress. I think some of my colleagues have done a great job of that. Take Paul Ryan, for example. You know, we're roughly the same age in our 40s, and you know, Paul has been here longer than I have, but he's said, hey, look, we know about what's going to happen in the future, and if we do nothing about it, that's very sad. I mean, it's dangerous. And so I think young people are realizing that they're forced to pay into Social Security and perhaps never see a benefit under the current formula. And more people paying attention to their financial future is a good thing. We want to leverage that for better policy here in Washington for the American people.
And I think what you're speaking to there is just the necessity of leadership in times like this of crisis. So thanks for your leadership, and I hope that will be continue to be spread in D.C. So one last question, and this is completely unrelated to anything we've been talking about, really. But you're recently married.
Right.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
So how do you see God's faithfulness in that relationship? And also, how do you balance your personal life with an incredibly busy work life? You know, a congressman's life is crazy. So how do you balance those things, especially as a newly married guy?
Well, fortunately, I have some family roots and some heritage in the family that have given me some great support, some great role models, and certainly I appreciate my wife and her patience for some meetings that I need to attend and can't get home in the evenings as early as I would prefer. But I think when you put all things together, you know, I'm better off when I get to worship on Sundays and hopefully some opportunities during the week as well. So I try to set those priorities and just in the schedule, get some of those basics in there, and it's amazing what can take care of itself with some good foundations in place. But I'm grateful for so many blessings, and you know, looking back, whether it's, you know, serving at the local level or even engaging in the private sector as a youngster, my brother and I used to paint addresses on curbs for $2.50 per address.
It's glamorous.
And then we moved up to selling snow cones, which was a lot better business, even though the price point was lower. But just looking at what we have in America, that motivates me. You know, the religious freedom that we've had in our country, unparalleled, I would say, around the world. I'm concerned, though, that some of that is slipping away. And we need, you know, we can't force religion on anyone. I mean, that's not, I don't think, what Scripture calls for. I don't think that is what is effective in terms of sharing our faith. But the freedom to worship as we would choose. That fits very well within free speech. It should anyway. And so when you look at building our country and building opportunity, I tell kindergartners when I speak to them in schools back in the district, I tell senior citizens that my job I don't see as guaranteeing an outcome as much as I want to work hard to ensure opportunity. If we ensure opportunity, that could be economic freedom, that could be religious freedom and a number of other categories. And, you know, economic freedom isn't just about dollars. It's about the measurements of time and the freedom to use your time as you would wish, rather than feeling compelled by the government, you know, the heavy hand of government to do certain things, to try to accomplish a certain outcome that President Barack Obama might think is desirable. But he doesn't know the potential of every one of the over 300 million individuals across our country. Let's focus on opportunity.
Well, that's a word that I think a lot of people here at AEI could agree on. So thanks very much for your time. It's been great having you on the show.
Again, thank you for the great work that you guys do, and look forward to working together.
Absolutely. America, America.